This meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee will come to order. The time is 3:20 p.m. on March 2nd. Members present are Representative Freer, Representative Sadler, Co-Chair Fields, and myself, Co-Chair Hall. We have a quorum. Please silence your cell phones. We're asking that staff and members of the audience not approach the table. If you need to pass a note to committee members, please get the attention of my committee aide, Joan Wilkerson, and she will take care of it. I'd like to thank Andrew Magnuson, the Labor and Commerce Committee Secretary, and Renzo Moises from the Juno LAO for tech and teleconferencing support. We have one presentation and two bills on the agenda today. The presentation is on the rising cost of health care for municipalities, upon which we will hear from three speakers. And the bills to be considered before the committee are HB 260 regarding construction project wages and liability, and HB 267 regarding employer contributions. HB 267 is a bill, is a governor's bill. The first item on the agenda is the presentation of the rising cost of healthcare for municipalities. Assembly Vice Chair of the Municipality of Anchorage Assembly is Anna Brawley. Assembly Member Brawley will lead off the presentation, and we will hear from Terry Haynes, who's the mayor of Kodiak, followed by Maureen Hall, no relation, who's an assembly member from the city and borough of Juneau. Assembly Vice Chair Brawley, if you're on the line, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your presentation. Welcome.
Yes, thank you, Chair Hall. Hopefully you can hear me.
We can hear you.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. For the record, my name is Anna Brawley. I am serving as Vice Chair of the Anchorage Assembly up here in the municipality of Anchorage. And then I will also note that I am not speaking on behalf of the entire municipality or the entire assembly on this item, but I did gather some information that can be helpful to this discussion from our staff as well as from Anchorage School District, which is, of course, a separate organization, but one of the political subdivisions in our area. And I will likely not need a full 10 minutes, but I will give some numbers and some perspective and is happy to answer questions. So generally speaking, of course, we know the cost of health care is a huge issue in Alaska, and I know the committee has been hearing that generally. And, of course, anything that affects our residents also affects municipalities, everything from cost of care to the impact of inflation, and all of that that impacts our workers, workers' comp claims, things like that, right? Any kind of healthcare related cost impacts the public sector as well as the private sector. So I want to be clear about that. I think some folks perceive that there's maybe some different set of economic circumstances that impact governments versus the private sector, but I think we're all feeling the pinch here. And so just some kind of basic facts on our end, and I was able to get some information on recent prior years just to give some example of the cost that we're facing here in the municipality of Anchorage. So first I'll say the municipality is self-insured, as is the school district, although the school district does pay into the Education Health Trust for teachers and other entities. But essentially, we are managing our own risk. That means that we are paying similar to the way that the state has a self-insured plan, we are managing our own healthcare costs. That also means that our costs fluctuate year over year because it really depends on the claims that are being made by the population who is insured under our plan. I'll also note that we do have stop-loss insurance, and so if we have a very high dollar claim, we do have an ability to kind of manage our risk or our financial liability there. But, of course, we have to pay for that insurance as well. So that's all really part of the complex cost that we pay. So overall, what is the bottom line? Well, we pay about, at least in 2025, we have paid $64.6 million in terms of our cost. I'm sorry, I missed it, not $64 million. Actually, let me double-check that number really quick. I want to make sure that I'm using accurate numbers here. But essentially what we've seen over the last 2 years is that those costs are increasing significantly. So in the last year, it was at least about a 10% cost increase year over year, or maybe it was even more. One second. I'm pulling something up. So let me move on. So essentially, we are paying a significant amount in healthcare, and I'll give you a few stats here. So one is our actual average claims paid, so that's per member on average. In 2018, just a few years ago, that was $1,829. Then that went up kind of off and on over the last few years. So in 2021, it was just under 2,000. It was $1,997. And those don't sound like big increases, but of course that's the average number. So you can multiply that average by all of the folks that we insure or that we cover as our healthcare costs, which is thousands of employees. And so that really adds up. But in the last couple of years in particular, I can note that in 2022, that number went up another $300 or so to $2,242. And then in 2025, that's the most recent numbers I have right now, that went over $3,000. So again, just in under 10 years ago, it was about $1,800. Now it's about $3,000. So you can just see the escalation is really increasing. And then back to the kind of total numbers, the bottom line, that means that our total costs are going up. And so the number that I did say was accurate. So in 2018, we were paying about $47.5 million on the total cost of our healthcare plan. Of course, that's in addition to employee cost sharing there. In 2022, it was $53.5 million. And then in 2025, now it's up to $64.6 million. And of course, as I said, there's also employee costs there. And so as those costs go up, then folks are feeling it either in their premiums or in their out-of-pocket costs. One bright spot I could note is that we run our own healthcare clinic, the Vera Healthcare Clinic. From everything I understand, it has very high satisfaction both from plan members and from a cost perspective. So it's well known that having access to preventive services, primary care, and really, you know, routine care to manage chronic conditions, treating things early rather than letting them turn into a more expensive problem, and trying to prevent those much more impactful, not just to the bottom line, but to the person, those late-stage kind of diseases that, really drive costs. Those are all good things. And so having our health clinic gives employees and their families an opportunity to get that routine care at a place that they know where to access and can have consistent care, as well as really helping manage our costs in the long run. But we're also seeing that the cost increases that we're having is not necessarily commensurate with service use. And so in the last year, we had the number of services that the plan was paying for up by about 6%, but the actual cost of those is up 20%. So while you might think, well, you know, as your employee population ages or folks have families, right, and we're just seeing these costs increase as, you know, the number of services is increasing, but we know that the cost is really, as I said, really outpacing the actual utilization of the plan. And we've also gotten some information from our healthcare contractor. So they've said, you know, it's really not something that we are doing wrong individually as a municipality or that local governments are doing to mismanage costs. It's really a problem in the sector as a whole. So they said across the board, looking at employers, again, private sector as well as public sector, folks have been preparing for an increased cost of about 10 to 12%. But instead, we're seeing 20 to 30% increases, right, from 24 to 25 and then 25 to 26. I think there's a number of factors there, which I know this committee has unpacked. Some is changing technology, but a lot of it really is policy decisions and economic factors that I think, you know, we as a municipality may not have a lot of control over, but I think it's worth asking, you know, at what point are we going to really look at policy and look at changes to our healthcare system that would benefit not just the folks who are seeking care, because, of course, we all need health care at some point, but also making sure that we are managing the economics and the bottom line. So lastly, I'll just briefly say the same dynamic is certainly true in the school district. The information that I got is that they expect their medical costs to be about 19% of the district's general fund budget for FY27. That's over $113 million. Again, they have a very large workforce, of course, and so looking at major health care costs there. They've also found that medical care for employees has far outpaced inflation, and really in environments where we have zero-sum game in terms of our budget, it means other budget reductions that have to make room for that increased cost of care. It also can mean pushing more costs to those employees through in premiums or through out-of-pocket costs, and sometimes it can actually result in benefit reductions too, right, trying to manage the plan through what services are being offered, how generous the coverage is, and all of that. So one way that they've done that at the school district, unfortunately, and really not anyone's first choice is, again, to shift that cost to employees. So they've seen insurance premiums go up for many employee groups. So we know that, again, all of the pinch that the private sector is feeling, that households are feeling around healthcare, is also being felt at the municipality. And we have a responsibility to balance our budgets and to make sure that we are using taxpayer resources wisely. And so it is difficult when these costs really, for the most part, feel out of our control and then are competing with all of the service needs that are also being affected by inflation, whether it's gasoline for the fleet vehicles that plow the roads, or the cost of buying supplies, or really, again, making sure that we're hiring and maintaining qualified people by offering competitive benefits and making sure that those folks are healthy and avoiding injury. And so there's a lot of pressures there. And then lastly, I'll just say, as you know, one individual who represents, you know, over 40,000 people, but also is a small business owner, self-employed person, it is very difficult to see how we can grow our economy when all of us are really facing extremely high health insurance premiums, to say nothing for the actual cost of care if you try to go use that insurance. And so we know a lot of folks are covered through large employer plans. Those larger pools manage the risk, or they spread the risk out among many people. But to the extent that we want to see small business, we want to see Alaska-based businesses that employ people, that make things, that sell things, right, that really drive our local economy. It is difficult when those folks are either asked to shoulder all of those healthcare costs and their employees, or to say to their employees, sorry, we can't cover you, and so you've got to figure that out in your own household budget. And so I think it's something that really we're feeling across the board, certainly here in Anchorage, and I can imagine every other community in the state as well. So with that, I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Ms. Brawley. I want to recognize for the record that we were joined by Representative Carrick at approximately 3:22 p.m., and we were joined by Representative Colomb at approximately 3:25 p.m. Ms. Brawley, we have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Brawley, you have provided a lot of information, delivered at breakneck speed. I'm hoping you can get time to take a breath there. But so that I can give proper attention to your information, do you have written comments you'd like to submit to us? We can review your comments at our leisure.
Yes, to the Chair, Representative Sadler, I'm happy to do that, and I'll get those to that.
Sure. Thank you. And to follow up for my real question.
Follow up.
You offered us, to the extent I could follow what you were saying, you gave us some information about the health care costs in the municipality and the Anchorage School District. I heard in there some advocacy for specific policies or issues. I would appreciate you, if you've got specific recommendations on policy, that the information you provided is designed to buttress, I'd appreciate hearing those clearly, please.
Yes, well, thank you so much. So,
absolutely.
I don't have specific recommendations at this time for state-level action, but I can note that one way that we have been able to manage our healthcare costs and also increase really the employment experience for our employees is the healthcare clinic. So it's the Vera Healthcare Clinic that's located in Anchorage that is available for municipal employees and their families. I think investing in and making sure that we have good coverage of preventive care services, of primary care services, and programs that help folks manage their chronic conditions, you know, whether it's diabetes or other heart disease, other things, I think anything where we are investing in those services is very helpful. So I know those are covered in other plans. They're covered through Medicaid. They're covered through, you know, it's typical in an insurance plan now that those are covered. But for plans that are exempt from, say, the Affordable Care Act requirements, we know that there's number, you know, the Muni plan is technically exempt. There's others that exempt. I think it's still good policy and good financial management to make sure that we are allowing for primary care and preventive services to be fully covered. And then I guess the other thing, too, is, you know, historically, this isn't the first time that the state has faced rising healthcare costs. I was trying to find it, and I wasn't able to before the meeting. A very old version of the Kenai Peninsula Borough Comprehensive Plan, I think from the 1990s or early 2000s, actually identified rising healthcare costs as an issue. And at that time, one of the plan recommendations, which of course was more showing, you know, the age of that plan than anything, was saying, well, what if we were self-insured as a borough? What, you know, not just for employees, but for everybody in the borough. And they were really looking at options. You know, there were healthcare management organizations back then and other options. But the fact that a local government was really actively exploring how to insure its entire population is a really interesting, again, artifact, I think, of that era, but also shows that this is not the first time this conversation has come up. And there's been a lot of creative thinking historically on what our options might be at that level.
Follow up.
Thank you. And the historical citation, it sounds like you are indeed getting close to making recommendations for interesting policy options. But you mentioned one success the municipality of Anchorage has had with the health care clinics for municipal employees and their families. Are there any municipal strategies to address high health care costs for residents who are not employees of the municipality?
Yes, through the chair, thank you for the follow-up question. To my knowledge, trying to think if there's any that we are working on right now. I think the challenge is, of course, the local government, even though we're a home rule municipality, we have very limited ability to influence the healthcare landscape overall. And so I think it's hard to answer that question in terms of what we in the municipality or we the assembly could pass that would have a meaningful impact. And so I think that's, again, why we really look to the state and other levels of government, as well as in the private sector, to ask, you know, what can be done and what are those cost drivers that are really affecting all of us.
Thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Representative Cologne.
Thank you. Through the chair, hi, Anna, Ms. Brawley. I had a question, and maybe I should know this, but who negotiates with the health insurance companies for the muni? And is there much negotiation, or is it just they just give it to you and that's what you get?
Yes, thank you, through the chair, Representative Cologne. That is a good question. I can certainly say that the assembly is not the one to negotiate because I have never been privy to those conversations. We do have an HR department, and so my suspicion is that it's through the HR department and folks like the municipal manager, you know, who are really managing the operations of the city. But I can follow up and get an answer on that.
Yeah, I'd like an answer to that. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cologne. Additional questions from Representative Sadler?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. If Ms. Brawley could add that to the other written documents she hopes to plans to submit to us. Thank you.
Yes, Ms. Brawley, if you could please email my office, we can distribute it to committee members when it becomes available.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time and presentation, Ms. Brawley. Next, we will hear from Terry Haynes, the mayor of Kodiak. I see you online here, Ms. Haynes. If you could please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Yes, can you hear me?
Oh. Yes, we can hear you.
I was following on gavel. Well, thank you very much, co-chairs, and thank you to the committee for your time. Sorry, I'm at home. The dangers of being at home.
I'm sure. At ease.
Yeah. And we'll take a brief at ease. Labor and Commerce is back on the record. Mayor Haynes, if you are ready and perhaps in a quieter location, we would love to hear your testimony.
Yes, thank you for your patience. Well, and thanks to Vice Chair Brawley for offering so much great background. We're in the same situation, I think, as the municipality in Alaska right now. Increased health care costs, a growing burden on the budget of all of us. But it's not just the ballooning health care costs. It affects the bottom line of our citizens and boroughs. It also affects our ability to retain staff. Instead of a raise in pay, we pay increased health insurance premiums, which often go unseen and unnoticed by the employee. But it does affect them because it erodes the ability of the employer to increase their own wages. And as Vice Chair Brawley pointed out, it doesn't correspond with an increase in services. So, in a way, deflation in our healthcare dollar is affecting our ability to keep up with inflation. in our compensation with our employees. But to take a slight turn, at least in public employees have health insurance. Now that the subsidies have lapsed on policies offered by the insurance marketplace, I fear that we will see the reversal of one of the biggest steps forward in the health of our community here in Kodiak, and that's health insurance for fishermen. Like all entrepreneurs in Alaska, health insurance is simply out of reach for many fishermen. That changed with the exchange. Now that the subsidies are gone, I fear that many fishermen will once again go uninsured. Last year, almost 29,000 Alaskans had health insurance policies through the federal marketplace, and out of those, over 25,000 received enhanced subsidies, according to figures published by the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services. The average age of a fishing permit holder in Alaska is 50 years old. According to estimates by the Alaska Division of Insurance, now that the subsidies have expired, a single 50-year-old who earns $58,650 per year will see their monthly health insurance costs rise from $282 per month to $407 per month for a silver plan. This is a significant increase, but you could actually end up more poor by making more money. For Alaskans who earn more than $78,000 per year, for an individual 50-year-old, they would end up going from paying $534 per month for a silver plan to $1,415 per month. Under a bronze plan, their cost would go from $9 per month to $890 per month. Without subsidies, a 60-year-old Alaska couple earning about $82,000 will see their premiums increase by $44,000, or half of their income. So who are we talking about here? Deckhands with rent to pay and kids to feed. Skippers with boat payments to make and fuel to buy before the next fishing trip. Many will make the hard choice to go without insurance, and I think we will all pay the price in the form of a less healthy population with a health care plan called emergency care. This uncompensated care is a burden on all our hospitals and increasing costs for everyone. And that's the point I would like to make, I think, here today, and I'm, of course, open for questions. Thanks for your time again.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor Haynes. Are there questions from the committee? Seeing none, thank you for your presentation, Mayor Haynes. Next, we'll hear from Maureen Hall. Thank you. Next, we will hear from Maureen Hall, Assemblymember for the City and Borough of Juneau. Assemblymember Hall, please put yourself on the record and introduce yourself and begin your presentation.
Yeah, for the record, my name is Maureen Hall. Good afternoon. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I currently serve on the City and Borough of Juneau Assembly. However, today I'm not speaking for the Assembly, but from my experience, I bring more than two decades of experience as a nurse focused on children and families, first in the pediatric clinic setting and then for 17 years as a school nurse in the Juneau School District, followed by 2 years as a state school nurse consultant before transitioning to public service. I'm also a mom, a grandma, and a board member and volunteer with a nonprofit serving some of the most without a doubt, the most vulnerable citizens of our community. Healthcare delivery is incredibly complicated. If there were an easy fix, we would have done it by now. The systems that generate profit are often invested in preserving the status quo. Fundamentally, our country needs transformational, radical change. But while we work towards that, we want to know what we can do here in the state of Alaska, in our communities, to reduce the cost and improve outcomes. Also got the late question of, has the expiration of the Affordable Care Act premium tax credit impacted your community? And I reached out to city management, and, that's not something that we would see at the city staff level, but definitely it's certainly affecting people in our community. When people put off seeking care until it's an emergency, drives the cost up for everyone. I would like to focus on three areas that impact costs from my experience: workforce, our hidden healthcare delivery system, and prevention. First, the workforce. Our community hospital faces some of the same pressures as any business operating in Alaska. Workforce shortages, lack of affordable housing in our communities, and limited child care options. On top of that, hospitals carry enormous fixed costs, and we do not have the economies of scale that larger states rely on to make numbers work. Healthcare workers relocating to Alaska also expect well-funded public education systems for their children. Across our state, we're struggling to fill vacancies, and healthcare is no exception. I want to acknowledge the really strong Grow Your Own program at our local Bartlett Regional Hospital, which is a city-owned and operated facilities. Through distance learning and partnerships with educational institutions, employees can continue working while pursuing nursing degrees, CNA, other healthcare credentials. These programs are essentially and deserve continued support. We must also recognize that healthcare, like many sectors in Alaska, relies heavily on immigrants. We need federal immigration processes that provide stability and certainty for the workers themselves and for their employers. In our community, I'm personally aware of two frontline caregivers who left because of immigration instability. One had been a permanent resident for years, but when applying for citizenship, an old visa overstay previously resolved during the green card process resurfaced and triggered removal proceedings. Another was a CNA from Haiti under temporary protected status, here under that status. And when that was suspended, she made the heartbreaking decision to move to Canada to join a sister there. She told me, I didn't think I would like this work. You know, she wasn't sure what it would be like being a nurse assistant. She says, but the residents made me love it. We invested in her training. Our seniors relied on her care, and we lost her not because we didn't need her, but because the system lacked stability. Small businesses face similar strain. Many want to provide health care benefits but simply cannot afford them. Workforce challenges directly drive up health care costs. The second thing I would like to draw your attention to is the unintended consequences of years of underfunding education. In Juneau, when budget cuts loomed a decade ago, school nurses were among the first positions reduced. Yes, school nurses are often referred to as the hidden healthcare system. In Alaska, this role dates back to the territorial days when my neighbor, who's in her 90s, shared with me that the territorial governor at the time said, what is the point of educating the students if they don't live long enough to utilize their education? So at that point in time, in at least our big five, the five largest district school nurses were brought on. And today, we have school nurses serving in all but 17 of our 54 districts. But fiscal pressures due to the underfunding of education have led to many districts needing to cut back with, school nurses. We manage chronic health diseases, respond to emergencies, support behavioral health, coordinate with families and providers, and partner with our public health nurses during outbreaks. We're just a plane ride away from a measles outbreak, and that will certainly drive the healthcare cost up in our state if we have to deal with that in a significant way. School nurses play a critical role in ensuring that immunizations are up to date and responding quickly when public health issues arise. When COVID happened, I know our own school nurse workforce, healthcare workforce here in Juneau with the school district was repurposed to the call center, and a great benefit to the community. When we remove school nurses, those needs don't disappear. They shift to the emergency rooms, to parents having to come pick up a child that might be able to otherwise stay in school. And families may not always have the means to navigate the complex systems accessing care. The third thing I would like to touch on is prevention. I'm always looking upstream. And, with the nonprofit work I do, we operate the the cold weather shelter for our community, and we're averaging over 40 residents a night. And it's very expensive to provide, you know, folks living on the streets access emergency services and just really struggle to get through the day, and it's, you know, very expensive. So if we're serious about controlling healthcare costs, we must invest in prevention, particularly in preventing early childhood trauma. The landmark Adverse Childhood Experience Study demonstrated that the more trauma a child experiences early in life, the greater risk of chronic disease, mental illness, substance use disorder, and even early death in adulthood. Prevention is not just compassionate, but it's also fiscally responsible. I'd like to share an example from our local Bartlett Regional Hospital. They have the Hello Baby program, and it serves as the Alaska Plan of Safe Care, which is under a federal mandate tied to child welfare funding, specifically addressing prenatal substance abuse disorder exposure. When the flexibility to design Alaska's approach, Bartlett chose not to create a stigmatizing substance-only program. Instead, they built a universal voluntary program available to any family. And this program is actually a statewide program, and they're hoping, if they're able to access some of the rural health transformation funds, that they will be able to provide additional training statewide so other municipalities can replicate this model. Services range from educational resources, including connections to programs such as Parents as Teachers, which is a home visiting program, to intensive case management for families navigating substance use treatment and reunification with their children, and this program is free. This work recognizes a fundamental truth: real health transformation happens in the home, not in the hospital. Many of our highest risk families lack stable housing. If a family doesn't know where they're sleeping at night, it's nearly impossible to focus on recovery, parenting, or preventative care. Hello Baby helps provide safe sleep supplies. You know, they want to make sure that every parent has, you know, a pack and play for their older children, safe sleep bassinet for their infants, smoke detectors, medication lock boxes, all practical supports that reduce risk immediately. The program avoids shame. Instead of saying, "Don't use substances, we'll see you in 2 weeks," it walks alongside families at every stage. One, the program manager I was speaking to highlighted the heartbreaking fact that as these mothers come out of treatment and are being reunified with their children, they kind of fall off this needs cliff of not, you know, they're newly sober, and suddenly they face the financial strain of supporting their children, often with limited housing and employment options. The stress can be overwhelming, and asking for help is hard. So Hello Baby began as a one-person effort, but it was never realistic to replicate a full in-home visiting model. Instead, it coordinates existing expertise and builds partnership. I'd also like to highlight my experience living in Canada and giving birth to our third child there. Within just a few days, we had a public health nurse come visit in the home and make sure everything was going okay, weigh the baby, make sure breastfeeding was going well. And those visits continue as long as there's an educational need with the parents. The same public health nurses would conduct all the well child visits. They weren't done in the pediatrician's office, but with public health nursing, and then referred if there were any concerns. They also administered the immunizations and continued to follow these families throughout the school years. That seems like a wonderful model that would be worth considering here in Alaska. So prevention, workforce stability, and maintaining our hidden healthcare infrastructure, these are practical community-level strategies that can reduce healthcare cost over time. And I realize everyone's on a two-year cycle here, but I really encourage you to think long-term and down the road. healthcare reform at the national level may feel out of reach, but strengthening our workforce, restoring school nurse funding, and investing in prevention or early childhood, especially the 0 to 3 segment of our population. Thank you for your time and your work on behalf of all of us, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Assemblymember Hall. We have a question from Co-Chair Fields.
Thank you, Ms. Hall. That was very comprehensive testimony, and I enjoyed all of it. It is a it's the bizarre nature of our fiscal notes that departments look at the cost and never the savings of anything, mm-hmm. which is how we've defunded early childhood care, even though it saves money.
Yeah.
So we consistently don't fund things because, quote, there's no money, even though not funding things ensures that there will never be any money
yeah.
for anything that would actually lead to a functioning community. I was curious, so you said the situation might justify substantial change in the structure of healthcare. You probably saw that we had a hearing on other states have established state plan options. We've started to research some of those. Washington, Colorado, Nevada just established ones. Would you encourage us to continue to look at those options to see if that might work for Alaska?
Yeah, I certainly think anything that's kind of comprehensive, that the economies of scale, I think that would be well worth the effort and perhaps banding with other states. But
thank you. Could I ask a follow-up?
Follow-up.
So you, through the chair, you talked about the nexus between education funding, healthcare. I'm guessing that rising health premiums in the Juneau School District have constrained your ability as both a borough and a school district to adequately fund classroom operations and hold down class sizes. How high are class sizes right now in the Juneau School District?
Oh, gosh. That would vary across different grade levels, but I know one of my grandsons had 32 third graders in his class last year. And the teacher said, the other grandmother who also lives here volunteers in the classroom, and she said by the time the teacher presents the lesson, it's impossible to go back and individualize with all the children. And, he's a bright little kid, but what a sad situation for any kid that needs extra help. It's near impossible to provide it. So I can't speak to what the school district is paying for healthcare cost. I did reach out to the city finance, our finance person, and she said that between last year and this year, our costs have held steady. But like Anna on the previous call, I have not delved into what that's doing in our the city or with our school district.
Ask a follow-up.
Follow-up.
So if the legislature cut education funding this year by failing to keep pace with inflation, how would that impact the Juneau School District? What additional cuts would the Juneau School District have to make?
You know, and again, I'm sorry I don't have that information, but I know it's always a struggle to, they'd like to provide everything they did, back when there was art and music Yeah, and I know I can speak specifically to what it did cutting school nursing services and how challenging that was. You know, when a very large percent of our children receive special education services and almost all those categories that qualify them for special education services have to do with their health. And if you don't have anyone at the table who has any healthcare knowledge or background, you're not serving the families as well as we could and making sure that there's no health-related condition that's impacting their ability to learn. And if there is, lessens the ability to mitigate and accommodate for that disability. So,
okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would respectfully contest the co-chair's expression that if the legislature cuts education by failing to increase education funding to account for inflation or something to those words, certainly there are differences of opinion, but language counts. And to say that a failure to inflation adjust increase is a cut is just a little bit Orwellian. So just want to get that on the record.
Thank you, Representative Sadler. Additional questions from the committee for Assemblymember Hall? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony today.
Thank you.
Assemblymember Hall, and thank you also to the other testifiers, Assemblymember Anna Brawley and Mayor Terry Haynes from the City of Kodiak. We appreciate your time. This concludes today's presentation on the rising cost of healthcare in municipalities. We're going to take a brief at ease while we transition to the next item on our agenda. At ease. Okay, the House Labor and Commerce Committee is back on record, and we are actually going to make an agenda swap. We're going to be, instead of going directly to HB 260, we're going to take up HB 267 first, followed by HB 260. So with that, HB 267 is about employer contributions. The bill is sponsored by Governor Dunleavy. Would Mr. Boyle please come forward, introduce yourself for the record, and begin your presentation.
Madam Chair, thank you. My name is Robert Boyle. I serve as a policy advisor and consultant to the Office of the Governor. And I have some additional support here.
For the record, Paloma Harbor, Director for the Division of Employment and Training Services with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Thank you, Ms. Harbor. Mr. Boyle?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I can't tell you how excited I am about having the opportunity to present this bill. It has a significant potential to affect the Alaskan economy through workforce development. And it's one of those rare bills that will come to you pre-funded, and that is because of the Unemployment Insurance Fund being over-capitalized to the level where the funds, the trust, exceeds the amount that's necessary to continue to operate well. That over-capitalization suggests that the Alaska economy is healthy and that there is low demand on the unemployment benefits at this time. That's great. That means people are working. Out of that status, three items come forward: taxes, benefits, and training. Those are the three aspects that are involved within the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. After passing through what I would consider a severe stress test during the COVID era for a high unemployment, to now be overcapitalized in such a short period of time that where the level currently rests, it suggests strongly that within the three components there can be adjustments that are healthy and remain the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund to remain healthy. UI has a unique relationship within the Alaska State Training and Employment Program, STEP. They have gone hand in hand since 1981 to Alaska Statute 2320-290, and it was more clearly defined by the feds in 2000 through the establishment of WIA, the Workforce Investment Act.
Mr. Boyle, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just want to make sure, is this all your introductory remarks? Should
yes.
we be going through? Okay, so we should not be starting going through the PowerPoint
no.
slides. Okay,
thank
just
you.
Wanted
I'm
to make
sorry.
Sure.
I'm sorry, my apologies.
Okay, no
we'll
problem.
Have that up here in just a moment.
No problem. Thank yeah. you.
The STEP program, which I had mentioned is funded through UI, is proven to be very successful. It funds more than 3,000 employees annually, and it is in high demand by employers, such that the funds that support it are usually exhausted well before the end of any fiscal year. So the UI fund has more than necessary. It's intertwined with STEP, and STEP doesn't have enough to continue. So this bill offers a pathway to resolve both issues. Legislative permission is required to balance the funding and increase worker training. Apprenticeship programs are one of the strong features within STEP. Apprenticeship programs are proven to be very effective ways in the fact that they respond to the needs of the employer and the employee, being generated generally by the employer. One of the things we're looking at within training programs is the what I would call the paid-to-learn type of programs. And we look at what type of youngsters or demographics that we're trying to recruit. Currently, that conversation would center around what you might call Gen Z students. And Gen Z has been classified by recruiters' retirement processes across the United States as age 13 to 28 age bracket. And a lot of recruiters are starting to term them as the tool belt generation, meaning that they have a preference for blue collar type of work, and that experience that comes to them through paid to learn, apprenticeship, intern types of programs. So there's this triad that's out there under the UI system: taxes, programs, benefits. This bill addresses the taxes and programs. The funds, when they're appropriately distributed, come around to balance out the fact that benefits can also be increased well within the context of the overall balance of the UI fund. Actuarial tables would needed to be designed to figure out how these three amigos can work together. But again, it comes down to balancing out the needs of tax reduction, benefits increases, and the expansion of training programs. And we'll jump into the slides. Thank you. Up first on the slides is a cover of the Alaska Workforce Future. This was a document produced out of a 2023 meeting sponsored by AWIB. That's the Alaska Workforce Investment Board. The convening that took place in October of 23 was, I've been in vocational training, vocational education types of programs in various capacities for 35 years, and also other educational programs. I'd never attended a convening, a workshop of any sort that was as well done as the convening that took place in 23. It brought together industry leaders from across the United from across the state, and then educators and trainers from across the state, and they had some very frank heart-to-heart conversations about what should take place in Alaska. Out of it was developed then through AWIB, this document which brings those to light. One of the things that weaves through the Alaska Workforce Future is the need for apprenticeships, and that's why I brought that up so much at the beginning. The outlook for jobs in Alaska is very good. We're currently sitting 340,800. That's the highest job level we've had in Alaska, and it looks more promising to continue to grow.
I'd like to note for the record that Representative Nelson joined us at 4:13 p.m. Thank you.
What the STEP program does is recognize training that leads to certification. And the the statute that support the state training program is listed here. And I wanted to note that in 26, the Alaska Workforce Investment Board received a total of $11.2 million in applications, while there was only $7 million available for the funding. So our employers and employees across the state see and value this a great deal, more than we can put out at this time. Examples of people that use the funds. The funds are distributed in a very systematic type of process to ensure quality distribution. And I want to turn over, the funds come from UI, and I think that is, I don't know how to say it other than whether you want to lower taxes or keep them the same, whether you want to increase benefits or expand benefits or keep them the same, whether you want to expand or limit the training programs, all three of those affect each other. But what we don't want to do is go after the goose that lays the golden egg. So maintaining the fiscal health, stability of the unemployment insurance trust fund has got to be the priority that comes out of any of the decisions that are made. And I'll turn that knowledge over.
Thank you. Again, for the record, Paloma Harbor, Director for the Division of Employment and Training Services with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. Thank you for this opportunity to present on House Bill 267. This slide shows the balance of the Unemployment Insurance, or UI, Trust Fund since January of 2019. And I apologize, it's not as easy to read on the screen. But the trust fund reached a high of $506 million in November of 2019, prior to the pandemic, which it was able to weather, as mentioned previously, reaching a low of $267 million in March of 2021. And then it fully recovered to $517 million by October of 2022. As of November 2025, the UI trust fund balance was $821 million. Which exceeded the statutory solvency target of 3 to 3.3% of wages by $247 million. This overcapitalization, which was mentioned earlier, of the UI Trust Fund is primarily due to the fact that employers have a statutory minimum contribution of 1%, which is preventing taxes from coming down to the level the current balance and economic conditions would otherwise require. Assuming no change in economic trends impacting wages or benefits, the UI Trust Fund could go without employer or employee contributions through 2040, that's 14 years, and still exceed statutory solvency targets by more than one percentage point.
Representative Sadler, you have a question?
Thank you, I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. Before we go on to the next chart, if I may, this chart picks up in January 2019, and it shows a pretty dramatic change. What would the chart look like in the decade before 2019? Was it fairly stable? Did it have the same kind of precipitous highs and lows, or at least just highs?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, we do have other historical charts. You would have seen a little bit of fluctuation in the decade prior related to the Great Recession. There was a dip in the fund as well during that time frame. But I don't have those details ready in front of me. We can get you a chart.
That'd be helpful because to predict that what's happened in the last 5 years is going to be carried in the future. You never know what the past is probably a good predictor of the future. Mm-hmm. And to assume that the overcapitalization is going to last, it'd be helpful to know what the current tax situation did for the capitalization level of the fund in the decades prior, or just the decade prior.
Sure. Through the chair, we'll be sure to get that for you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
I would just say what I know Lennon would say if he was here with me, our UI actuarial. the system is built to replenish itself. The statutes are written really well in that regard. It weathered the 80s. This trust fund, you know, in the 80s was a major crash after the pipeline, and this system was able to survive. So just a comment on there. Okay. This chart shows the current flow of employer and employee contributions to unemployment insurance, the state training and employment program, and the technical and vocational education program, or TVEP. Employees currently pay a 0.1% tax to STEP, a 0.25% tax to TVEP, and while according to statute they should be contributing 0.5% to UI, that is reduced by their STEP and TVEP contributions to just 0.15%. Based on taxable wages paid last fiscal year, that would equate to $10.8 million in revenue to STEP, $27.1 million to TVEP, and $125 million to the trust fund, the UI trust fund. That's employer and employee contributions, I think. Currently, all employers except those in the penalty rate class are paying the statutory minimum tax of 1%.
Ms. Harbor, what is the, how did you classify it, penalty class? What is that?
At the time that taxes are set for the upcoming calendar year, if an employer has defaulted on their payments or their quarterly reports, then they have to pay the penalty rate for that upcoming calendar year.
Thank you.
This chart shows what the contribution flow would be for STEP, TVEP, and UI underneath House Bill 267. The UI taxes for employers with more than 1 year of experience would be able to go to zero as long as the UI trust fund's solvency warrants it. Employers would pay a new STEP tax of 0.4% until such time as they have to start paying back the UI trust fund, and then their STEP contributions would be reduced by the amount they were paying to UI. In calendar year 2027, which was the effective date of this bill is January 1, 2027, alone in that calendar year, it would mean an overall employer savings of $68 million. And it would greatly expand the state's capacity to develop an Alaskan workforce to meet employer demand. Okay. This chart, or table, this slide shows unemployment and STEP projections through 2040 under House Bill 267. As you can see, the reserve ratio would start to approach 3.3%. Here, I'll show you where that is. I know it's hard to see. So here we have the new employer STEP contributions, the existing employee STEP contributions, and the total STEP revenue, then employer UI revenue, employee UI revenue, and the total UI revenue. This reserve ratio is the one that I was talking to about earlier. In statute, the target reserve ratio should be 3 to 3.3% of wages. Even with the reduction in employer contributions, we don't start nearing that reserve ratio target until 2040, at which point employers would then start to have to contribute to UI again. Any questions?
Representative Carrick, followed by Representative Sadler.
Thank you, through the co-chair. The reserve ratio percentage going down over time, does that currently fluctuate very much year to year, and is it a concern at all that it does continually drop down? Like, would we have to come back and revise statute later to prevent that number from continuing to drop?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, no. That's the point, is that this would allow the unemployment trust fund to come back into alignment with what would be considered solvent, a normal solvency level versus an overcapitalized level. So that's what this legislation allows to happen. It allows it to come back down to a level that it should be. At that point, when it reaches that target solvency, as employers are then maybe moving forward have to contribute, their step tax would be reduced by the amount that they would then contribute to the UI Trust Fund. So the UI Trust Fund statutes are written to where when it needs to, employer contributions will increase. But currently, the statute does not allow them to decrease to an adequate level. Does that?
I think so. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, and through the chair, Ms. Paloma. Perhaps the answer to my question is buried in the testimony we've received so far, but in 2040, the bottom line of the chart and the screen there, the fourth column, employer UI revenue, jumps from $7 million to $15.5 million, roughly. And that's why, again? What's the change that happens then?
Okay, so this chart is a little bit simplified from the nuances, right?
There's okay,
yeah.
Good.
I know, I'm sorry. There are 21 rate classes. The penalty rate class,
okay,
that we talked about, and then 20 other rate classes. And that employers are supposed to be assigned to different rate classes based on their actual experience in turnover. So those that have more turnover and thus rely more on the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund are supposed to pay a higher tax. And they do well when it's not overcapitalized as it has been. Right now, everybody except the penalty rate class is paying the 1% minimum. But historically, employers with a higher turnover pay a higher tax rate. So what you're seeing on here is the average employer tax rate, which is rate classes 10 and 11. That's this column right here. So while on average, the average employer might be paying 0.03, there would be nine rate classes higher than that would be bringing in revenue to the UI Trust Fund.
I do apologize to the chair. I lost the thread of your explanation about three points back.
Sorry.
The 0.03
So the main...
why is that so much bigger?
Because employers would then start contributing to the UI Trust Fund again because we're getting closer to the okay. solvency level.
Okay. There's an answer. Thank you.
Yeah, sorry about that. Thank you.
Representative Colon.
Yeah, through the chair, this conversation sounds familiar. So I want to try to simplify it for the public as well. So we're taxing employees and employers for unemployment insurance. Mm-hmm. Now, it's my understanding that we're one of the few states that actually tax the employers, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Colon, we're one of three states to tax employees.
Oh, employees.
Yep.
Yeah, that's what I meant. So our employee tax is a little unusual. Mm-hmm. So when it's overfunded like this, why wouldn't we get rid of the employee tax? Yeah.
Through the chair, Representative Colon, that is certainly something that could be done. There's only a 0.15% tax still going to the trust fund. So it would not move the solvency down. I mean, it would stay overcapitalized, even if you eliminated the employee contribution.
Can I have a follow-up?
Mm-hmm. Follow-up.
And so here you're taking the employer side of things. You're reducing it from 1 down to 0.4, and we're calling it a step tax rate. Is that how it's going to be, like, are employers going to be aware that this is contributing to step instead of just... I suspect most people don't know that we're doing this. Most employees don't know that a lot of the unemployment insurance is going to CTE training.
Through the chair, Representative Colon, yes. In the fiscal note, which we didn't speak to, is the programming necessary to make sure it's very clear that this tax is for the state training and employment program, because we have to keep it very separate from the federal contributions to the UI Trust Fund.
Right. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the co-chair. I have, I think, two questions. Following up on the first question I had, why is this last line, 2040, suddenly going in the employer UI tax rate to 0.03%? Why is that last line different?
Through the chair to Representative Carrick. So as I mentioned, as we get closer to this reserve ratio and as employers are assigned to different tax rates, they have to start contributing again. We've drawn down the trust fund balance. Now we're reaching the target solvency level. Employers then have to start contributing to unemployment again, and it reduces how much they'll be giving to STEP and increases how much they'll be giving to UI.
Okay. Thank you. That was the piece I was missing earlier. I have a separate question.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you. Through the co-chair. I'm not really super familiar with how employer and employee contributions to UI work in other states, but just going back to the chart on slide 9, is it typical for the in states that have an employer contribution rate for it to be this much higher than the employee contribution rate? Because we have 1% for the employer, and the employee is 0.5%. I guess I'm trying to do a little compare and contrast. Is that typical?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, again, it's my understanding there's only 3 states that even have an employee contribution. Mm-hmm. Almost all states are 100% employer funded. I believe when we set up the employee contribution, it was with the understanding that some of that would be used towards training, which is, again, why TVEP and STEP were established, was to retrain individuals to get them employed so that they draw on unemployment for a shorter amount of time, right? And it helps the overall solvency of the system. Currently, only employees are contributing to the training system, and House Bill 267 would have employers also start contributing to the training system.
Just one last follow-up. Thank you, through the co-chair. We've talked about how the STEP program would be impacted with this legislation. Mm-hmm. Would there be impacts to the TVEP portion?
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, no, there are no changes to the TVEP program as a part of this legislation.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm.
I have a question for Director Harbor. Because you had mentioned there are different classes of employer contributions based on the utilization of the UI benefits from their employees. Can you talk about seasonal employers mm-hmm. and how that bill may or may not impact them?
Co-Chair Hall, so the bill doesn't change the way seasonal employers are treated, right? Rates are based on experience by the employer, regardless of this legislation, right? So employers with more turnover are assigned potentially a higher tax rate, depending on their experience. And that's in statute currently. Does that answer your question?
I believe so.
Sorry. So as I mentioned previously, there are 20 non-penalty rate classes, and we look at the wage base of the employers quarter to quarter, right, in the highest and the lowest quarters of their wages, and that helps assign them to the different rate classes. So again, employers with significant change in wages, we assume their employees are then collecting unemployment insurance and they're drawing more from the system, so the statute's written to require them to pay more into the system. That's the way it works.
Understood. Thank you. I believe mm-hmm. Co-Chair Fields has a question.
Thank you, through the chair. I was just curious about sort of organization on discussions around this bill. Is Lennon Weller still working for the department? He's still the actuary?
Through the chair. Co-Chair Fields, yes.
Okay. And then Mr. Boyle, nice to see you through the chair. So you're working for the governor, but sort of assigned to help the Department of Labor?
Yes.
Okay.
Excuse me, through the chair.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you.
Since you opened that door, Co-Chair Fields, I have a question, and maybe this is more of I'm in my freshman term still. I've not seen this before when it comes to someone from the governor's office presenting a bill for that's the governor's legislation. Can you just maybe talk a little bit more about that process and fill in my knowledge gaps?
It's my first time doing so as well. I'd like to get back to you on any details you'd like to have on that.
Co-Chair Hall, this is a governor's bill. This is the first hearing on the governor's bill, and those are usually presented by a high level, and then we go into more details with like a UI actuarial or someone like that at a secondary hearing potentially. And Mr. Boyle's been contracted with the governor's office to work on workforce development matters, and STEP is a major contributor to those workforce development matters, and so was asked to present on the legislation.
Thank you very much, Director Harbor. If you would please continue with your presentation.
I believe that wraps up our presentation.
Oh, okay. Additional questions from the committee? If not, I have a question. Director Harbor, could you talk about how the reimbursable part, like when our, can you just talk a little bit more for the committee's awareness when it comes to the reimbursable part and like how that works? Because like my understanding is state employees in the state of Alaska doesn't pay in, but there's a reimbursement factor involved with that?
Yes, Co-Chair Hall. So the reimbursable employers pay 100% of the cost of the unemployment cost for their employees back to the trust fund. So during calendar year, each quarter we say, here's the draw from your employees, state of Alaska. It was $20 million. I'm making that up. And then the state of Alaska writes us a check for $20 million, and we deposit that into the trust fund. So any reimbursable employer reimburses 100% of the cost. They don't pay a tax rate.
Okay.
And, okay. Yeah. Any other questions on that?
Not at this time. Okay. Additional questions from the committee? Seeing and hearing none, we will set this bill aside. Unless is there invited testimony, or Ms. Harbor, you were? Okay. Okay, great. With that, we will set this bill aside. Thank you very much for your presentation today. Going back up the agenda, we will now move into hearing HB 260. HB 260 is about construction project wages and liability and is sponsored by Representative Josephson. Representative Josephson, would you and your aide Ken Alper please approach the table, put yourself on the record, and introduce your bill.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I'm Andy Josephson, House District 13 at South Midtown. I'm the sponsor of House Bill 260. With me is my staff, Ken Alper. And I hope that the committee has time for two invited testifiers in this inaugural hearing of the bill. We also have a brief PowerPoint. This bill, ladies and gentlemen, does a number of things. It could have been, arguably, two bills, and I'll explain that. But it does a number of things that relate to trying to keep the construction work site a place where there's a fair playing field, and there's honesty, and there's transparency. A number of years ago, I was on this committee, and there was a bill that efforted to do a lot of these things, but the only thing that passed, ultimately, to my memory, is the creation of a statutory definition of independent contractor in 233230. It's cited on page 3. One of the things related to this that this bill does is in the context of unpaid construction wages, so that's part of what this bill is about, is it creates a rebuttable presumption that all people working for a project manager or contractor are that person's employees. And that's because we know that there is a problem with independent contractors who aren't really independent contractors. And you might say, what does that mean? You just said they were independent contractors. Well, if you apply the test that I've just described under 233230 or any common law, you would find that, in fact, if you really knew the facts on the ground, they are not legitimately independent contractors. And so that relates to one of the overall parts of the bill, which is wage theft. So what we're trying to do is find out who can best police the problem we have in the state of wage theft. Who can police that? And typically, or often enough, although Oregon has just adopted this essentially this model bill, so we're not flying alone here, but often you would have regulators who work for the Department of Labor that do that. But they're expensive, and efforts to increase the number of regulators to make sure that there's fairness at the work in the field and at a construction site simply aren't there. So you have inequities where some people are legitimately trained in their field. They have a certificate of fitness. That's another element of this bill. And other people aren't, and they're hired, if you will, on the cheap. They claim to be, or they're told, as the case may be, that they're independent contractors, when by rights, they really are employees. And one of the ways you could tell that, if you monitored it, is you would know that they keep showing up at the same site, working for the same person over and over and over, much like we come into this building every day, right? No one would call us contractors. We're legislators. We're employees, effectively, of this building. The problem that arises is that the good actor in the field, who is trained in their field, whether it's plumbing, engineering, construction, they're paying UI, which you just had a hearing on, they're paying workers' comp, they're paying Social Security, they're paying Medicare. And these other folks aren't doing that. And the general contractors, in some cases, not all, but in some cases, they're allowing or encouraging that so that they can do this. And for the record, what I'm saying is they can say those types of payments are your problem, not mine. After all, you're self-employed. You don't really work for me. So this bill is designed to look at all of those issues. And we believe the best policeman, if you will, at the job site is the general contractor or the program manager or project operator. They're at the top of the pyramid. And what this bill does is it first says, and this is where, frankly, it could have been two bills, but what it first says is, does somebody have a certificate of fitness? That is, do they have proof that they're skilled at the skill they're working on? And if they don't have that skill, this bill says we're going to enhance the penalty that exists now. What's the penalty that exists now? Virtually nothing, because we don't have regulators. That's problem one. Problem two is, weirdly, it goes to criminal court, as I understand it. And this bill would say, no, we're going to stay in civil court. But better yet, we're not even going to go to civil court. We're going to have a civil fine, and we're going to have the Office of Administrative Hearings enforce those civil fines. In other words, we're not going to bother the court with these problems. We're going to deal with them administratively and faster. And failing that, then folks can appeal to court. So it puts the burden on the contractor to show that the persons they're hiring have certificates of fitness. They are ready to do competent work, just like would happen on a full-fledged site, if you will. The second thing it does is it says, because of this concern with wage theft, unbeknownst to me prior to this bill, although I could imagine it, is that the employees at the bottom of the rung, the bottom of the pyramid, who often work for subcontractors, are not fully paid their wages. Now, how does this happen? Well, subcontractors come and go. Remember, many of them are not, and I hate to say this because it sounds harsh, but they're not fully legitimate. They don't have certificates of fitness. They're not fully licensed. And guess what? They don't fully pay their employees. This bill would say that the general contractors are jointly and severally liable for those payments. Now, you might say, well, why are they liable? They're not necessarily their employees. They are the employees of the subcontractor. Well, someone has to be liable. Now, what this bill would do is it would say that the general contractor is going to be liable for all the employees in the list. That is, think of it as a vertical arrangement. Okay, they're responsible for all of those salaries, but they can subrogate. That is, they can say, "Hey, I paid subcontractor Freer's employees, and you were obligated to do it, and so I'm coming after you for what I paid. That's just a matter of basic fairness. All of this is designed to protect workers, first and foremost, keep the playing field legal, so everyone's playing, or sorry, keep the playing field fair and legal, so everyone's playing by the same rules. And so there's lots going on in this bill, and I think I've done as good a job as I thought I could this morning at describing it, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that will go to a quick PowerPoint.
Representative Sadler. Did you have a question?
I do have a question. Through the chair, Representative Josephson. Curious about looking at a couple of fiscal notes for the Cook's view of this. Changes in the enforcement of contractor licensing and COF requirements. How are violations of the contractor licensing and or certificate of fitness requirements generally discovered, and by whom?
Through the chair, I think what's happening is I invite any of the invited testifiers who support the bill, quite obviously, because that's what happens often, to tell me where I'm wrong. But I think there's a little bit of a Wild West going on out there. So frustrations that someone didn't pay their workers, someone didn't have a certificate of fitness, they just go by the wayside. And so there's probably a pecking order where bad experiences are remembered and you hire someone who's maybe more legitimate or more law-abiding. The reason I give you that answer is I think there's not much enforcement, right? Because right now, weirdly, you have to end up in a small, low-level, I don't know if it's a B, it looks like a B misdemeanor because it's a $500 fine. This would increase that to $1,000 but make it administrative, and it's a civil penalty. Incidentally, one reform we would, or one amendment, the committee, which now owns this bill, congratulations, the committee might entertain is getting rid of the current obligation in law that an employee could be tagged for violation of the certificate of fitness provision. You'll see that the key word is at line 13, page 1. And we would think it was a friendly amendment to say, look, the employee is not in the best position to police themselves. It's really the boss at the top of the chain, or bosses, that need to do that.
Just real quick, Representative Sadler, I believe one of the invited testifiers has a plane to catch, and I'm not sure of the timing of that. So we might want to hold questions for now. And come back to it.
I do want to come back because there's one question hanging. So if this increases the penalty, the question stands: how are they discovered? So, but
Mr. Alper,
Madam Chair, to Representative Sadler's question, I mean, more or less, there are inspectors from the Department of Labor. They catch these things. They go to job sites and they see someone doesn't have the paperwork, but the bar is really hard to get a misdemeanor conviction now, actually going through a court process that my understanding, and the invited folks will be able to speak much better than me, it's hard to enforce. You rarely get to the actual penalty. So the intent of the bill to make it administrative is to streamline the process of being actually had the repercussion.
So who would enforce it then?
The Department of Labor, through the chair.
The inspector's good. Thanks. I'll follow up on that later.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Sadler. For now, I do want to hold questions so that we can get through the sectional and get to Mr. Griesley's testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a very short slide deck, and really, Representative Josephson, as he always does, is very thorough and covered a lot of the ground. I'll just be rehashing some of it. The bill structurally is doing two major things. This idea that a contractor, the certificate of fitness statute is limited to the electricians and plumbers, that you're required to have a certificate from the Department of Labor that says you're qualified. It's a test that you take generally after you've gone through the apprenticeship program and you're now qualified to do this work. And the danger is when someone gets sent to a job site to do plumbing or electrical work without such a certificate, they might be doing it substandard, dangerous, and so forth. So we need some enforcement mechanism to make sure that that's not happening. And then the second half of the bill is the wage protection, making sure everyone gets paid. And it's really two different portions of the bill. On slide three, the certificate fitness are in sections one and two with a small conforming change in section four. And like I said, this is required for plumbing and electrical work. If you send someone without the certificate, like I said in the answer to Rep. Sadler's question, there is the fine, but it requires getting a conviction, and it's just hard to do. So making that penalty administrative, making it something that could be issued internally, and also creating a higher potential penalty. If you keep doing this, they could take a contractor's license away, and that's obviously their bread and butter. That's what they want the most, is to be able to continue working, particularly if there's multiple violations. The conforming change in Section 4, that's in the Office of the Administrative Hearings. There's a laundry list of different issues around the state that they cover, and this adds a new item, number 50-something, to the list of number 52 to the list of things that the Office of Administrative Hearings is engaged with, the hearing examiners. On slide four, the next major change is the wage protection. Representative Josephson talked about the broader problem of unpaid wages, and also that there is often, particularly when they're subcontractors, people might come to the state for a particular project, a company might form for a particular project and then dissolve. That if that company goes away and there's a wage claim, there's really no one to enforce it on. And the key words in the bill are jointly and severally liable. It creates the standard whereby the obligation to make sure those wages get paid steps up to the contractor themselves, to the person hiring the subcontractor who's hiring the person. And that's important just so that there's some degree of recourse, frankly. So it goes from the subcontractor up to the general contractor, and in certain cases to the project owner, and there are exceptions to that, which I'll get to in a moment. The bill also includes information provisions where a contractor can request their subcontractors provide them certain information about their employees, about any past violations they might have had, clarifying this sometimes gray area between who's a contractor and who's a direct employee. So all of that is covered in this new requirement for information exchange between contractors and subcontractors. There's a lot of data out there. I just threw a couple of points into the slide. 14.6% of construction workers in Alaska are misclassified. I can't speak in greater detail than that, which I read in a report, but I'm guessing some of the invited testifiers might be able to. And obviously there's a loss that happens when taxes are avoided and someone ends up having to pay that. And like Representative Josephson said, this bill was modeled on a bill that passed in Oregon sometime in the last several years. Now, the exceptions to the wage theft protections, the most obvious one, if the employee in question is in a union and that union has a grievance process to cover unpaid wages, well, then that takes precedence over what might be set up by the state here. And also, project owner is a broad term. If the project owner is most of them might be people who are professionals in the construction business who are building something for themselves. Some of them, it's just like a homeowner or something that's hiring people to work on their house. And when it's a principal residence, we're not creating liability on the homeowner for whatever a contractor's malfeasance might be. Likewise, a small residential project of five or fewer units, the contractor remains liable, but not the project owner or a single unit, a commercial project. So sorry to rush through it, Madam Chair, but I know we have a gentleman at the airport. So I could take questions now. We could also hold until after the invited testimony, and we can come back.
We'll hold questions for now. Representative Josephson?
Madam Co-Chair, the person with an airplane issue is not this gentleman. So if we took the first invited testifier.
Mr. Greasley?
Yes. I think that would be the efficient
way. Absolutely. Representative Josephson, thank you. So first, we're going to have Boris Griesley, Policy Director of the Western State Regional Council of Carpenters, available, followed by Alden Zellhuber, Business Manager for UA Local 262 with the Plumbers and Pipefitters. We also have Sylvan Robb here in the audience as well, Director of CBPL, available to answer questions on the bill. So with that, Mr. Griesley, please identify yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and committee members. I'd like to start off by thanking Representative Josephson for sponsoring this very important piece of legislation. My name is Morris Gressley, and I am the political and policy director for the Western States Carpenters. And for more than a decade, I've been working on legislation similar to HB 260 across multiple states and have seen three clear results in the states that have enacted this piece of policy. Number one, cheated workers get paid faster. Now, you might ask, why is that? Well, the reason why cheated workers get paid faster is because every single civil action or the threat of civil action forces the general contractor, the developer, and the subcontractor to come together and settle before that civil action goes to court. And so in majority of the cases that we've in majority of the states where we've seen this piece of legislation adopted, workers get paid faster. They don't have to go through a bureaucratic process that takes years on end. Number two, a culture of compliance and self-policing is established, leveling the playing field for responsible contractors. And number three, states recover lost revenue from law-breaking contractors, helping fund vital public services. It's important to be clear about what we are trying to address today. Wage theft is not accidental. It is a business model. Contractors who steal wages can underbid honest contractors by as much as 30% or more, creating a powerful incentive to continue cheating when enforcement is weak. Now, opponents may argue that this bill will hurt contractors, increase construction costs, or fail to address the problem. And the facts on the ground show the opposite. In other states that have enacted this piece of legislation, contractors have not been harmed. In fact, the complete opposite has happened. They benefited from a fairer, more competitive marketplace. There's also no evidence that holding owners or upstream contractors accountable increases construction costs. Housing cost studies, for example, have not identified labor accountability laws as a cost driver. We actually have real-world data showing that up the chain liability actually works. There are two organizations, one called the Carpenters Contractors Cooperation Committee and the Workforce Defense League, and collectively these two organizations have been able to help over 500 workers and recoup more than $5 million in stolen wages. These outcomes are not theoretical. They demonstrate that accountability works, workers get paid, and responsible contractors are protected. One piece that's very important to note is that there is an opportunity to cure here. So I know sometimes there's this rush to say that a general contractor or developer might not have their due process. Well, they actually do as part of this bill. This bill essentially says you have the right to correct the issue before a worker goes and files a civil action against you. So we're trying to protect responsible contractors, protect workers, protect the industry, and root out the bad actors. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your time, Mr. Gressley. I apologize I mispronounced your name at the beginning. We have a question for you from Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Real quick, briefly, sir, what is the Western States Carpenters? Is it associated with organized labor? Is it a trade group? Is it a nonprofit? What is it, please?
Correct. We are a union.
Representing carpenters in multiple states?
We are a construction trade union representing construction workers across 12 different states.
And presumably including Alaska?
That's correct.
Very good. May I ask how many?
A follow-up question, Representative Sadler?
Yeah, lots of Alaskan workers or a couple or what?
Through the chair, we represent collectively throughout the Western states 90,000 members.
How about Alaska?
Through the chair in Alaska, I believe we represent over 2,000.
Thank you very much.
Seeing no further questions from the committee, thank you very much for your time, Mr. Gressley. We appreciate it. Next, we will
thank
hear.
You.
Thank you. Next, we will hear from Alden Zellhuber. I hope I'm not butchering your last name there. Please come forward to the table, introduce yourself for the record, and begin your testimony. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Alden Zellhuber for the record, and I'm the business manager for Plumbers and Pipefitters Local 262 here in Juneau, Alaska. I've been in the piping industry, plumbing industry, for this is my 30th year. Most of that time spent out in the field. I spent 2 years as the state plumbing inspector here in Juneau. When the governor decided to move that position to Palmer, I went back out into the field. I wasn't moving to Palmer. But I have been the business manager for 262 since July of last year. I'm here to speak in particular to sections 1 and 2 of this bill that require a certificate of fitness. The current statute that requires a certificate of fitness, as was mentioned, says that it's to not have one is a Class B misdemeanor punishable by a $500 fine after you have been convicted. Part of my responsibility as the state plumbing inspector was to find people that were in violation of that. I was basically told that I could give them a piece of paper that was a cease and desist ordering them to stop and that letting them know that they were in violation, but that the state Department of Law didn't have the resources to pursue these kind of cases, and so basically it was a paper tiger and people have caught on that there's no real penalty to be in violation of the statute requiring a certificate of fitness, which puts an incentive on those that are bad actors and are sending people out on jobs and to people's homes that don't have the required training and the required licensing to be working on plumbing or electrical work. That those being the two primary areas that the state requires a certificate of fitness or a license. This bill tries to put some teeth back into that. It's difficult to catch somebody that's doing that. As an inspector, I would go onto job sites and occasionally would catch them, and it was often kind of the repeated bad actors that you would find doing those things that I could give them basically a warning, and if I caught them again, I could give them another warning, but there was no real penalty, and this bill is to rectify that situation, or these sections of this bill. I guess with that, if there are any questions.
Okay. Representative Cologne.
Thank you. Through the chair, what is required to get a certificate of fitness for a plumber?
Thank you. Through the chair, a plumber is required by the state to have 8,000 documented hours working under the training of a journeyman. So it's generally 4 years of working on the job. There's also in classroom training of a minimum of a couple hundred hours a year, and then when they produce to the state evidence that they have that training. After review, they can take the test, and they are required to then receive at least 70% of the test. And if they are, they will be able to receive a state plumbing license as a journey worker. Electrical is similar.
Yeah. So that seems like a lot of hours and a lot of – that seems like a lot. Is that normal for other states? Is that pretty standard?
It is. There's a lot to know to be able to do it right. And I mean, it isn't – it's ensuring public health and public safety. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I would try to emphasize on to some of these bad actors that as I would find them out in the field is that it's kind of all fun and games until the lawyers get involved. Their insurance as a contractor is not going to protect them if they are doing work that they are not licensed to do, but that doesn't help the homeowner who is potentially putting somebody not doing things wrong where they could have floods or they could have fires or they could have who knows what problems. I've come on a number of jobs where I've seen things that were, the wrong fittings were used in the wrong place and in the wrong direction and pipe sizes were all done wrong and it all had to be cut out and redone. And often that would be at the homeowner's expense.
Thank you. Representative Sadler, then Co-Chair Fields.
Thank you, sir. Got the first name, Elton. Tell me your last name again, please.
Zellhuber. Zellhuber.
Just like it sounds. Very good. Thank you. Let's see. In your opinion, as a plumbing inspector and as a longtime professional in the field, what percentage of violations of 0818 are actually caught, and how many actually end up resulting in conviction under the current statutes?
In my 30 years, I have never seen any result in conviction under the current statute. I have heard of one, but that was before I entered the plumbing field, so more than 30 years ago. That happened here in Juneau where it was so egregious that the state decided to take that to court. As far as percentage getting caught, it's a very, very minuscule percent. The state, at the time that I was the state plumbing inspector, had three state plumbing inspectors and three state electrical inspectors for the whole state. There were two, one in Southeast, a state plumbing inspector and a state electrical inspector. There were two in the interior based in Fairbanks, a plumbing inspector and an electrical inspector, and there were two in South Central. The time that I went back into the field, they moved my position for Southeast Alaska to Palmer in an attempt to save some money, which meant that Southeast Alaska basically was not getting any inspections. Shortly thereafter, the state electrical inspector from Southeast retired, so they did not have a state electrical inspector in Southeast, which has become more of the Wild West scenario since then. It was hard to catch them before, but without any inspectors for several years, they know that the people out there know that there's nobody looking. And it makes it much more difficult for there to be any kind of enforcement. In the last couple of years, they have brought a state plumbing inspector back to Southeast to try to help with some of that.
Is follow up to this line of questioning, Representative Sadler?
Slightly off-kilter, I guess. I was going to ask that you mentioned the Wild West, and I get this image, but is the loss of a contractor's certificate on a second offense a little too harsh? You mentioned Wild West. I guess the second time you steal a horse in the Wild West, they hang you. They don't wait for a second offense. But is that the question might be, what does it take to get a contractor certificate, and is total loss on a second offense a little harsh? Would escalating penalties, financial penalties, be a better way to go, or...
So as far as what it takes to get a contractor's license, it takes going and getting a bond, getting a business license, and paying the state money for a contractor's license.
Not that tough.
You have to have some money that you can put up for your insurance and your bonding and for your licensing. But there's no requirement for a contractor's license to have the background that there is, like for a certificate of fitness. That's done through the Department of Commerce, but yeah, it's not all that tough. Losing their license, I would hope, would be something where it would be a little more difficult to get it back. I'm not sure. I know if you have your bond taken away, they're not too keen, the insurance companies, to issue a new bond. I don't know how the state looks at that.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, Co-Chair Fields.
Thank you. For committee members who are interested in research on the prevalence of wage theft, there's a good book called The Fissured Economy by David Weil, the former head of the Wage and Hour Division. In the previous session, former committee chair Jesse Sumner also talked about his experience of wage theft, so he's a good resource about, is this problem real? How does it exist in the state of Alaska? I just wanted to mention that for anyone who's kind of spends any time around the construction industry, there's a pretty significant nexus between safety and wage theft. Contractors who bake wage theft into their bid structure are also those who endanger their employees, which has a negative effect in terms of workers' comp on the whole industry. So it is in the interest of the industry to improve safety. One way that you do that is you encourage compliance with the law, which this bill would do. So I would just encourage people to think about that nexus. One example, I was taking my kids home this summer past the Hilton. There were some people up on a ladder working on the exterior of the Hilton. There was one person who was probably 40 feet in the air, unsecured on a ladder. You know, there's those little feet at the base of the ladder. They were turned up. The ladder was resting on the pavement. Could have slipped out at any minute. So I stopped, and the person who was holding the ladder actually walked away from it. And I told him, hold that ladder. One of the most dangerous things I've ever seen. And I asked the employees who they work for, and they got very nervous. And it turned out they were from a contractor in Florida. And, you know, this is an example of an employer engaging in egregiously unsafe behavior. And, you know, an Alaska-based contractor who follows the rules should have that contract. So I did call the Department of Labor. By the time the Department of Labor got there, all those employees were gone, I doubt. They remained in the state very long. And that's just an example that, you know, compliance is a good thing for workers and our economy. I did have a question for the bill sponsor and maybe Mr. Zell Huber, too. I think the bill reads $1,000, period. That doesn't strike me as a very meaningful fine. Should it be $1,000 per some period of time, per day, per week? That might be something I would be interested in pursuing via amendment.
Through the chair, if I may, the way the current statute is, it reads, and I don't believe that this bill would change it, is that every day is a new violation.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
So as a inspector, every day I could write them a new piece of paper and hand it to them, but that was about as far as I'd go.
Okay. Thank you.
Are there additional questions from the committee for the bill sponsor or for Mr. Zell Huber? Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair to the sponsor, you might not be the best person, but the gentleman who was with the Western States Carpenters is gone. Do the other states that have adopted similar legislation have the penalty for the contractors of loss of license after a second offense? Do you know that? You might not. That's a detail, but you might.
And I do see that Mr. Gressley is still online, so
I think he would be the better source.
Okay. I thought he was catching.
Mr. Gressley, are you still there? You appear to be there on my list.
Yes, I'm here.
Did you hear the question, or do you need Representative Sadler to repeat it?
Through the chair, it would be great if the question was repeated.
Okay. Certainly. Mr. Gressley, the question is, do the other states that have adopted legislation similar to House Bill 260 also carry with them a penalty for contractor violations of, on a second offense, losing their contractor registration?
So the joint and several, through the chair, the representative, the joint and several liability concept of the bill does not include penalties or suspensions or revocations for contractor's licenses. Those are usually two separate things. in all the other states where we've pushed this similar piece of legislation, it's been standalone.
Appreciate that. I'm not speaking so much of the language of this bill, but just from your knowledge of existing, you know, status quo statutes in these other states, is that penalty there?
Oh, I see. I'm sorry. Through the chair, Representative, yes, not every state has, some states do not have a licensing or a contractor's licensing requirement. But for the states that do have a contractor licensing requirement, there are significant penalties for violating the different provisions within the licensing statute. So, for example, if you are falsifying, or for example, if you are sharing a license, or if you are selling a license to another unlicensed contractor, there is a significant fine to that. In fact, in Oregon, a fine like that has now been increased to a Class C felony.
Follow up. Thank you, and sir. I'm just trying to get an idea about some relative status of the degree of punitiveness of the full loss of a certificate of a contractor's certificate. Do other states jerk your certificate if you violate any aspect of the law?
It is tiered. So through the chair, Representative, it is in some states you do have a tiered approach, which is to say if you are unlicensed, you can face criminal prosecution. That criminal prosecution can be as simple as a Class A misdemeanor. However, if you repeat that offense and you're unlicensed and you're performing construction work, then you can actually face a Class C felony. So there are many states that have not only attached civil penalties, but have also attached criminal penalties to being an unlicensed contractor operating in construction.
Okay, and if I may sharpen the question yet again through the chair, so do states that, not speaking of unlicensed, but for states that have a contractor registration requirement, and if those registered contractors violate statutes, do those states have penalties that start with or on second offense include revocation of that registration certificate?
Yes.
Maybe we'll talk offline. I'll try and get that information from you. If you're the Western states, if you have 12 states you cover, you might be able to give me a more comprehensive look at what other states do, but we'll follow up later. Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Representative Sadler. Additional questions from the committee? Seeing none, do you have any wrap-up comments, Representative Josephson? Anything that you'd like to share?
No. I appreciate the questions. I noted the one amendment that we would deem friendly relative to employees. I don't have any other comments or questions.
All right. Great. Representative Sadler?
Thank you. This is not a question. Please don't take my plethora of questions as hostility. I do appreciate the sponsor bringing this bill forward. Having sat in this committee, I have heard about wage theft, and the egregiousness of the offense is clear to me, and so I appreciate you bringing forth a creative solution. I just want to see if it's appropriate, whether states are doing it, how effective they are. So thanks for bringing this up.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Josephson and Mr. Alper, and thank you, Mr. Zellhuber, too, for your time and expertise. With that, for HB 260, we're going to set an amendment deadline for next Monday, March 9th at 10 a.m. And with that, we have concluded our business before the committee. The House Labor and Commerce Committee will next meet on Wednesday, March 4th. This meeting of the House Labor and Commerce Committee is adjourned at 5:16 p.m.